Good evening. President Trump seems to flip-flop again on stimulus negotiations. Why is more government money necessary? Volunteers helping migrants in the Arizona desert are raided by Border Patrol cops using a tank. And a new war in the South Caucasus threatens to escalate into a regional conflict involving Russia, Turkey, and Iran. And New York gets ready for another bout with COVID-19. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was released today after posting $1 million bond. Chauvin walked out of Hennepin County Correctional Facility in Minnesota after making bail. The former Minneapolis police officer was charged with murder after kneeling on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes in May. Chauvin is required to return for his next court appearance in March. And in a letter released by the White House on Wednesday, Dr. Sean Conley, Donald Trump's physician, says the president is stable and feeling great. Trump continues to experience no fever or symptoms just after returning to the White House on Monday. Trump was supposed to receive his fifth and final dose of remdesivir on Tuesday. His medical team said over the weekend it planned to keep him on dexamethasone, a steroid used to treat inflammation. Republicans are growing increasingly concerned about poll numbers that show a rising Democratic wave just 4 weeks before Election Day. Some Republicans fear Trump voters are not coming home, and the few remaining undecided voters are breaking decidedly against him and the Republican Party as a whole. Trump has refused to say he would peacefully cede power in the event he loses the election. Tonight, Vice President Mike Pence will face off with Democratic nominee Senator Kamala Harris in their first and only debate beginning 9 p.m. Eastern. It'll be broadcast from the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Trump's health and the coronavirus are expected to take top billing in the matchup. Either Pence, 61, or Harris, 55, would be a heartbeat away from assuming the presidency, depending on the election's outcome. In New York City, the coronavirus is on the rise in certain neighborhoods. That's led Governor Andrew Cuomo to impose a new plan for dealing with the outbreak. The new plan would replace the mayor's zip codes with zones color-coded red, orange, and yellow, depending on the strength of the virus outbreak. Last night, there were demonstrations in Brooklyn's Borough Park, where the health department says some of the new outbreaks are emanating. One man was beaten and hospitalized. A group of Orthodox officials wrote a letter describing the governor's plan as a duplicitous bait and switch. Rabbi David Zweibel threatened to sue.
Now, frankly, the last thing we want to do is have a confrontation of, that pits us against the governor and his medical people and so on. I hope we can avoid it. But as I said before, if we don't make any progress and we're left with what we are now, we would probably ask a court to issue a temporary restraining order until we can figure this all out. So that's where we stand, and I'm hopeful that in the hours ahead that we'll have some better news that we can celebrate.
And Brooklyn resident Meyer Ninmi says it's unfair to single out the Jewish community.
I understand why you need to wear a mask. I understand why you need to social distance. What bothers me is you pick on the good people. You didn't go to the riders when they're punching each other, throwing an apple, breaking Macy's. You didn't go, hey, take a mask. Because you know why? They would have thrown a stone in your face. Here, most of the people here have masks. One out of 100 don't have masks. And what are you doing is you're picking on people. And it's not right.
But Mayor de Blasio was firm at his news conference today. He says peaceful protests are welcome, but cops will crack down if there's violence.
I understand that there are people who disagree with this plan, and it is a democracy. We appreciate there's always going to be disagreements, but it's crucial that those who disagree still respect the fact that the state and city have made a decision for the health and safety of all. People have and will protest, and we understand that there is a place for peaceful protest. But the NYPD will not tolerate people doing harm to others. There will be no tolerance for assaults, for damage to property, for setting fires. Anything like that is unacceptable. And when the NYPD makes clear to anybody that they need to act in a way that's appropriate given the challenge we're facing, you must adhere to the instructions of the NYPD. If you don't, as in every other situation in this city, there will be consequences. The NYPD will give people warnings, will make the ground rules clear, but people have to follow those ground rules, or else, again, consequences come next.
De Blasio implored the public to follow the new rules as he laid out the zone system.
Back on the topic of the red pause zone. So red, defined as an area with 3% positivity over a 7-day average. And the geographic boundary depends on the density of cases. So in the red zone, all schools would be closed. In this case, they already are, all public and non-public schools. As of tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, all non-essential businesses in the red zones will be closed as well. Mass gatherings will be prohibited. Restaurants will revert to a takeout-only status. And houses of worship will be allowed to have 25% maximum occupancy and a maximum of 10 people inside. That's the red zone. Now, the orange zone is being treated as a warning. If red means a pause, a full pause, orange zone under the state rules will be a warning zone. And it basically comprises about a 5-block radius around the red zone. As of Thursday morning, schools in the orange zone will be closed as well. So again, as of tomorrow morning, schools that fall within those orange zones, both public and non-public, will be closed. In addition, high-risk businesses, including gyms, will be closed. Gatherings in the orange zone must be 10 people or less, whether they are indoor or outdoor. Restaurants will be for outdoor dining only in the orange zone, maximum 4 people at a table. Houses of worship will be allowed to be at 33% capacity with a maximum of 25 people inside. Finally, the yellow zone is a cautionary zone. It means an area where we're seeing a challenge, but thank God not as deep a challenge as other areas, where we hope to be able to turn it around with the cooperation and involvement of the people of those communities. See more cases, but we believe with the right approach, we can stop the yellow zones from turning into orange or red zones.
And Mayor de Blasio said fines for violators could range from $1,000 to $15,000 a day. De Blasio said he preferred the zip code model because he says they're clearer, but he added the city was ready to work with the state's model. The zone shutdowns will begin on Thursday. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In Washington, despite calls for civility and bipartisanship, hearings today at the House Oversight Committee on the IRS were anything but polite. Democrat Katie Porter of California got into a dust-up with IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig when she asked if he'd disclose investments in a building owned by Donald Trump during the Senate confirmation process.
Because in addition to the salary you receive as an IRS commissioner, you also earn between $100,000 and $200,000 per year from your ownership of 2 units at Trump International Waikiki. You have continued to earn this additional income while in office, correct? Yes or no?
Correct. And all of that was approved before I came on board and each year by the ethics officials of the Internal Revenue Service and other agencies, ma'am.
Mr. Rettig. Did you disclose that information to the Senate Finance Committee when you were nominated for the position?
Absolutely. And anybody who asserts in any way, shape, or form that there was a concealment is absolutely wrong. During my confirmation process, the Senate Committee received over 80 pages of invoices that specifically identified that property. The instructions for that property specifically say to put the city and state where all properties are located. That is exactly what transpired with respect to those properties and other properties that I own. And anybody who asserts to the contrary really does not know what they're talking about or the process.
Okay, Commissioner Rettig, there is no need to get upset.
Ma'am, I've been dealing with that since I came on board, and I do not take lightly anybody trying to disparage my reputation or my family's reputation.
Commissioner Rettig, I do not take lightly people attacking the members of this committee.
I do not intend to attack you, and if so, if it was received like that, I apologize to you and others.
The gentlelady command controls the time.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Porter.
The time belongs to me. Mr. Redding, since you're getting upset about that line of questioning, I'd like to try another one. How many economic impact payments, how many people are still waiting on their economic impact payments?
First, let me apologize to you if you took that as an attack, ma'am. I have to indicate that that issue has been out there, and if it came across as hostile or aggressive towards you, I do apologize. That is not who I am, and I certainly would not imply that to you or other members of the committee. So I would hope that you would accept my apology with respect to that.
Democrat Katie Porter of California questioning IRS Commissioner Charles Redick today on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows disclaimed reports President Trump was ready to restart stimulus negotiations with the House of Representatives. Last night, Trump abruptly cut off the negotiations, saying he'd wait until after the election to come up with an aid package.
Yeah, I don't know that there's any negotiating position. I think the president's tweet was recognizing what we all know right now is over the last several days, while we have been increasing our offers and actually looking at some of the ways to compromise, there hasn't been the same kind of effort on the other side of it from the speaker. And so to suggest to continue to go on with conversations that wouldn't have the support in the Senate was really something that we couldn't do.
And that's Mark Meadows, the White House Chief of Staff. Columbia Law Professor Michael Gratz is author of The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It. He says Trump's withdrawal from negotiations was puzzling and dangerous to millions of Americans.
I was really shocked when Trump said that he was not going to negotiate until after the election. It made no sense economically or politically to me. I just took it as a threat to the American people that if they don't elect him, he's not going to do anything for them. But that may be the wrong impression. I know others have different views. The American people desperately need new help. The unemployment insurance that ran out at the end of July created a lot of suffering for people who have not been able to go back to work or people who have lost their job. In the meantime, we just saw a couple of days ago that the Regal theaters closed. Every day, airlines laying off more and more workers, and coffee shops around big office buildings that are empty now closing. So many families that desperately need help. They're either unemployed or they're suffering. Evictions have gone way up. Many people are obviously now hungry. The American people are desperate for Congress to do something. And there are a lot of small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses that are suffering. They don't have the liquidity that large businesses do. They don't have the access to capital markets. They need help. Many of those businesses that are closing and will close in the next months won't come back. They really need to be able to have some liquidity that Congress had provided in March but hasn't provided since.
What's wrong in America that we can't redo what we did in 1932 when Hoover was kicked out?
The stumbling block has been the Senate. Only one-third of the senators are up this year for re-election. And there are a lot of Republican senators who are saying they're concerned more about the debt and deficits than they are about the well-being of the American people. There's also a myth that this pandemic has struck businesses and workers mostly in Democratic states, and that's clearly wrong. Cities in Wisconsin are now suffering. The state of Wisconsin is having huge problems. This is a pandemic that has traversed the country. I don't understand why our representatives are not willing to step up at this point and do something. The economy has appeared to be coming back slightly in recent months, and maybe that's induced some false sense of complacency in the Congress.
What's strange is this is not a populist platform. It's a platform of Reagan cut off the welfare mothers type of thing on steroids, which the president is also on.
It's the virus. While the virus has had a bigger impact on African Americans and Hispanics, it's not limited to people of one race. and it's affected people across the board.
Right. That's what I can't understand. I can't understand why they're not moving.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No, it makes, I have found that trying to understand Congress these days is really a fool's errand. And so I've given up. I'm looking for understanding. But it's clear job numbers started going up a bit, but there's still over 25 million people unemployed in the United States. Businesses are closing down and laying off workers every day. All you need to do is glance at the newspapers to see that many of the American people are in trouble and their families are in trouble. I don't understand politically what the sense is that we should not be spending money at this point.
Columbia Law Professor Michael Gratz is author of The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It. 2 weeks ago, U.S. Border Patrol executed nothing short of a military-style raid on Bird Camp, No More Deaths humanitarian aid station in the Arizona desert, 10 miles north of the southern border. The Border Patrol police, known as BORTAC, showed up with two helicopters, 24 vehicles, and a tank. But the tank, witnesses say, couldn't make it up the hill to the camp. No More Deaths has been providing food, water, and medical care to migrants who risk their lives in the harsh and arid desert of southern Arizona. Ariana is a volunteer for the group. She was there when the raid went down.
So No More Deaths is an organization that is working to end suffering and death in the desert. We put out water and food out in the desert for migrants that are traveling through. We also have a humanitarian aid camp set up. There, people can have access to medical assistance and food and water.
Where is this camp located?
The camp is located, I believe, 10 or 11 miles north of the border, just outside of the town of Aravaca.
This is the camp where this altercation happened with the Border Patrol.
Yeah.
What happened?
The day of the raid, there was about 20 plus agents and BORTAC, which is Border Patrol's special unit, on the ground there. There was a helicopter, there was people on horseback, there was ATVs, there was an armored tank, which couldn't make it over the hill, but it was on the other side, or arrested 12 people, and they detained 7 volunteers.
Was there any warning in advance that they were coming?
We had been notified the first night around 10 p.m. There was about 5 or 6 Border Patrol cars parked outside of the front of our camp. There was about 10 officers on foot searching around in the wash. We could hear them talking about getting a warrant to do it again, is what they had repeatedly said. It seemed as though they were looking for a sign to come into camp. This is the second time a raid has happened at our humanitarian aid camp since July 31st. It's becoming more often now. They are finding ways to come into camp and to stop life-saving humanitarian aid that's being given in the Sonoran Desert.
What's the rationale that they're using when I go into before a judge to go into your camp?
That they had tracked a group for 2 to 3 days into camp. So I think that's what we were witnessing on the first night, was them trying to find any sort of clue that that group had entered camp. They were in hot pursuit following someone into camp, because if they're in hot pursuit and they're actively behind someone, tracking them and following them, then they don't need to proceed with getting a warrant. Some of the communications that did happen on the second day, they had told us that they wanted people to walk out, or that they were going to proceed and get a warrant to come onto our property.
Who were the 12 people who were arrested?
The 12 people who were arrested were patients receiving care at our camp.
You have medical facilities?
Yes. There's doctors and nurses that work within No More Deaths and other medically trained people that are able to offer medical assistance to all of our patients there, to assist in any ways that they can with harm that people have received as they're walking through the desert.
Were you detained?
Yes, I was.
What was that like?
It was horrible. Yeah, it was really horrible to feel helpless, to feel like you cannot do anything to support people, to just watch as they run around in the darkness and walk people past you, that you were just assisting for, you know, whatever length of time that you were offering aid for and food for people that, whatever the reason is that they're coming into the U.S.
Were you put in handcuffs?
No, we were not put in handcuffs. We were detained in groups, and they just sat us down on the side of the driveway so we could kind of peek into camp and walk with them with their flashlights. They were all heavily armed.
Did they threaten to arrest you at any time or leave you with any warnings?
They had asked for our names and for our photographs. None of us were very, very willing to give over any of our information and stood our ground. They did not receive any of our names and did not. They took some photos of us a lot of us were pissed off at the situation, to see people not being able to receive medical care and attention, to see people being pushed out of this country in ways that are so despicable, and to see people be dehumanized by this organization that for 96 years has pushed people out into the desert to let them die. There's a lot of reasons to be pissed off, I think.
Ariana is a volunteer for No More Deaths, a group providing food, water, and medical care to migrants in the Arizona border desert. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called for an immediate ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan as fighting continues between the two countries over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. It's a region that last exploded into war in the early 90s, killing 30,000 soldiers and civilians at the time. An enclave of Armenia, Nagorno-Karabakh, is completely surrounded by Azerbaijan territory, although military success in the 90s managed to connect Armenia with the enclave. Armenia is a Christian country with a tortured history involving its neighbor Turkey. Azerbaijan is ethnically Turkish, allied with Israel. Russia backs Armenia, and that's worsened relations between Moscow and Ankara. Meanwhile, Iran shares a long border with both nations. Danny Shurgin is a writer and former U.S. military officer.
The boundaries that were largely imposed, whether it's by the Western Europeans or even Russian imperialists, often set boundaries that did not cohere with the ethnic groups that lived there. And the self-determination principle that comes out of World War I, especially World War II, has been not consistently applied. And so oftentimes we have these irredentist and sort of separatist wars that break out. And of course, they're often inflected with ethnicity and religion. Nagorno-Karabakh is kind of a perfect storm of all of these things.
You're saying that Azerbaijan is a more powerful country. How come it's Azerbaijani territory that's being controlled by Armenians' army?
The Armenians did very well in the earlier war. There's a number of reasons for that. It had to do with the population of Nagorno-Karabakh arming itself and being able to kind of throw off what they saw as the yoke of the Azeris. There was some Russian backing for the Armenian position, although it has been overemphasized and exaggerated in the West in order to kind of battle Russia. However, there was some of that. And by the way, the military parity in 1993, for example, was much closer than today. Now, Azerbaijan has a very aggressive and militarist and rather expansionist, interventionist big brother in Turkey's President Erdogan.
Armenia used to be part of Turkey. Were the Armenians actually mistreated by the Turkish government of its time 100 years ago?
The consensus of serious scholars agree that there was some form of Armenian genocide from about 1915 to 1921, so in the middle of and then towards the end of the First World War. The Turks removed Armenians who used to live further in Turkish territory, further west, and also in the big cities, and they literally moved them. I mean, created refugees, forced marches, a lot of them were shot. Many more starved and died of disease, maybe a million, maybe 1.5 million, depending on how you count it. Turkey still denies that there was any genocide. America won't even say that there officially was one because it doesn't want to anger the NATO allied Turks. But there's a real problem there. And Turkey has essentially cut off the border and trade and tried to isolate Armenia ever since the war. And the Russians have in many cases been seen as the better or only alternative in the region to Turkish aggression. And so that's the Armenian position, although it's rarely as clear as all that. And the recent pronouncements from Armenian leaders that this is a new genocide, this is Azeri attack, this is a new Armenian genocide, that's highly overblown and I think quite insulting to the victims of the real genocide 100 years ago.
Iran, they have the largest border of all with both Armenia and Azerbaijan. Are they looking nervously about what's happening?
The Iranians are Shia Muslim. So are the Azeris. Azerbaijan is one of the only other countries in the region that's Shia majority. Iran's position has not been particularly pro-Azeri over the years, over the decades. Iran has its own Azeri minority, which is significant. It's about a quarter of the population. There are more Azeris living in Iran than in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is one of the only Muslim countries in the region that has had a decades-long and only getting stronger relationship with Israel. buying hundreds of millions in arms, having Israeli trainers, Mossad may be involved in Azerbaijan, trying to sort of hem in the Islamic Republic. So the Iranians don't necessarily trust the Azeris or support their position. This is the worst breakout by far of combat violence in its intensity and in the number of people backing from the outside since 1994. And so that's troublesome. And there's just too many regional chefs for this thing to end quietly, though I am hopeful it will not take the number of years that it did in the Balkans.
Danny Shurshan is a writer and former U.S. military officer. And finally, a group of celebrities stripped down in a PSA about how to properly fill out a vote-by-mail ballot. Chris Rock, Tiffany Haddish, Amy Schumer, Sarah Silverman, and Borat joined in the nudity to make a point.
I'm naked.
I'm completely butt-ass naked.
I'm naked.
I'm, like, naked.
There isn't a man behind me. These are my hands.
Why you want me to be naked?
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Ruffalo, put your clothes on.
To be honest, I wish I could cover my hands with my boobs, but here we are.
I'm here to talk to you about voting.
Did you know that ballots could be naked?
And if you don't do exactly what I tell you, your ballot could get thrown out.
This is my ballot. Just got it.
First of all, when your ballot comes, you're supposed to read the instructions.
Read and follow the instructions that come with your ballot.
If they say to use a black pen, use a black pen.
I know that's like literally the least sexy thing a completely naked person could say, but...
But I have crumb like a can of Pepsi. Is problem?
Number two.
In some states like Pennsylvania.
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 There are two envelopes you have to stuff your ballot in. Otherwise, it's called a naked ballot.
Naked ballots. And you don't want to have one of those.
Number three, mail your ballot in as soon as you can.
Don't sit on them. Get those things out ASAP.
Like now.
Do it!
Naked celebs say now's the time to vote. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul Durienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.